about? I wondered. There were so many invisible cross-currents of emotion in the room that I had a sudden impulse to stand up and call the meeting to order, just to break the tension. Apparently, Jamie felt the same. He cleared his throat, looking directly at Ian, and addressed the main point on the agenda, saying, "We've brought the lad home with us." Ian took a deep breath, his long, homely face hardening slightly. "Have you, then?" The thin layer of pleasantry spread over the occasion vanished suddenly, like morning dew. I could feel Jamie beside me, tensing slightly as he prepared to defend his nephew as best he might.
"He's a good lad, Ian," he said.
"Is he so?"
It was Jenny who answered, her fine black brows drawn down in a frown. "You couldn't tell the way he acts at home. But perhaps he's different with you, Jamie." There was a strong note of accusation in her words, and I felt Jamie tense at my side.
"It's kind of you to speak up for the lad, Jamie," Ian put in, with a cool nod in his brother-in-law's direction. "But I think we'd best hear from young Ian himself, if you please. Will he be upstairs?"
A muscle near Jamie's mouth twitched, but he answered non-committally.
"In the scullery, I expect. He wanted to tidy himself a bit before seeing you."
His right hand slid down and pressed against my leg in warning. He hadn't mentioned meeting Janet, and I understood. She had been sent away with her siblings so that Jenny and Ian could deal with the matters of my appearance and their prodigal son in some privacy, but had crept back, unbeknownst to her parents, wanting either to catch a glimpse of her notorious Aunt Claire or to offer succour to her brother. I lowered my eyelids, indicating that I understood. No point in mentioning the girl's presence in a situation already so fraught with tension. The sound of feet and the regular thump of Ian's wooden leg sounded in the uncarpeted passage. Ian had left the room in the direction of the scullery. Now he returned, grimly ushering young Ian before him. The prodigal was as presentable as soap, water, and razor could make him. His bony jaws were reddened with scraping, and the hair on his neck was clotted in wet spikes, most of the dust beaten from his coat, and the round neck of his shirt neatly buttoned to the collarbone. There was little to be done about the singed half of his head, but the other side was neatly combed. He had no stock, and there was a large rip in the leg of his breeks, but all things considered, he looked as well as someone could, who expects momentarily to be shot. "Ma'am," he said, ducking his head awkwardly in his mother's direction. "Ian," she said softly, and he looked up at her, clearly startled at the gentleness of her tone. A slight smile curved her lips as she saw his face. "I'm glad you're safe home, Mukria," she said. The boy's face cleared abruptly, as though he had just heard the reprieve read to the firing squad. Then he caught a glimpse of his father's face and stiffened. He swallowed hard and bent his head again, staring hard at the floorboards. "Mm-hmm," Ian said. He sounded sternly Scotch, much more like the Reverend Campbell than the easygoing man I had known before. "Now then, I want to hear what you've got to say for yourself, laddie."
"Oh, well, I..."
Young Ian trailed off miserably, then cleared his throat and had another try.
"Well..."
"Nothing really, father," he murmured.
"Look at me,"
Ian said sharply. His son reluctantly raised his head and looked at his father, but his gaze kept flicking away as though afraid to rest very long on the stern countenance before him.
"Do you ken what you did to your mother?" Ian demanded. "Disappeared and left her thinking ye dead or hurt. Gone off without a word and not a smell of you for 3 days, until Joe Fraser brought down the letter you left. Can ye even think what those 3 days were like for her?"
Either Ian's expression or his words seemed to have a strong effect on his errant offspring. Young Ian bowed his head again, eyes fixed on the floor.
"Aye. Well, I thought Joe would bring the letter sooner," he muttered.
"Aye, that letter."
Ian's face was growing more flushed as he talked.
"Gone to Edinburgh," it said. "Cool as damn it."
He slapped a hand flat on the table with a smack that made everyone jump.
Gone to Edinburgh. Not a by your leave, not an I'll send word, not a thing but dear mother, I have gone to Edinburgh, Ian.
Young Ian's head snapped up, eyes bright with anger.
That's not true. I said, don't worry for me, and I said, love Ian. I did. Did I know, mother?
For the first time, he looked at Jenny, appealing. She had been still as stone since her husband began to talk, her face smooth and blank. Now her eyes softened, and the hint of a curve touched her wide, full mouth again.
You did, Ian, she said softly.
It was kind to say.
But I did worry, aye?
His eyes fell, and I could see the oversized Adam's apple bobble in his lean throat as he swallowed.
I'm sorry, ma'am, he said,
so low I could scarcely hear him.
I didn't mean...
His words trailed off, ending in a small shrug. Jenny made an impulsive movement as though to extend a hand to him, but Ian caught her eye, and she let the hand fall to her lap.
The thing is, Ian said, speaking slowly and precisely, it's no the first time, is it, Ian?
The boy didn't answer, but made a small twitching movement that might have been assent. Ian took a step closer to his son. Close as they were in height, the differences between them were obvious. Ian was tall and lanky, but firmly muscled for all that, and a powerful man, wooden leg or no. By comparison, his son seemed almost frail, fledgling-boned and gawky.
No, it's not as though you had no idea what you were doing. Not like we'd never told you the dangers. Not like we'd no forbidden you to go past Brochmorda. Not like you didn't ken we'd worry, aye? You kent all that, and you did it anyway.
This merciless analysis of his behaviour caused a sort of indefinite quiver, like an internal squirm, to go through young Ian. But he kept up a stubborn silence.
Look at me, laddie, when I'm speaking to you.
The boy's head rose slowly. He looked sullen now, but resigned. Evidently, he'd been through scenes like this before, and knew where they were heading.
I'm not even going to ask your uncle what you've been doing, Ian said. I can only hope you weren't such a fool in Edinburgh as you've been here. But you've disobeyed me outright and broken your mother's heart, whatever else you've done.
Jenny moved again, as though to speak, but a brusque movement of Ian's hand stopped her.
And what did I tell you the last time we, Ian? What did I say when I gave you your whipping? You tell me that, Ian.
The bones in young Ian's face stood out, but he kept his mouth shut, sealed in a stubborn line.
Tell me,
Ian roared, slamming his hand on the table again. Young Ian blinked in reflex, and his shoulder blades grew together, then apart, as though he were trying to alter his size, and unsure whether to grow larger or try to be smaller. He swallowed hard and blinked once more.
You said you'd skin me next time.
His voice broke in a ridiculous squeak on the last word, and he clamped his mouth hard shut on it. Ian shook his head in heavy disapproval.
Aye. And I thought you'd have enough sense to see that there was no next time, but I was wrong about that, hmm?
He breathed in heavily and let it out with a snort.
I'm fair disgusted with you, Ian, and that's the truth.
He jerked his head toward the doorway.
Go outside. I'll see you by the gate presently.
There was a tense silence in the sitting room as the sound of the miscreant's dragging footsteps disappeared down the passage. I kept my own eyes carefully on my hands, folded in my lap. Beside me, Jamie drew a slow, deep breath and sat up straighter, steeling himself.
Ian.
Jamie spoke mildly to his brother-in-law.
I wish you wouldn't do that.
What?
Ian's brow was still furrowed with anger as he turned toward Jamie.
Thrash the lad, and what have you to say about it, aye?
Jamie's jaw tensed, but his voice stayed calm.
I've nothing to say about it, Ian. He's your son. You'll do as you like. But maybe you'll let me speak for the way he's acted.
How he's acted? Jenny cried, starting suddenly to life.
She might leave dealing with her son to Ian, but when it came to her brother, no one was likely to speak for her.
Sneaking away in the night like a thief, you mean? Or perhaps you'll mean consorting with criminals and risking his neck for a cask of brandy?
Ian silenced her with a quick gesture. He hesitated, still frowning, but then nodded abruptly at Jamie, giving permission. Consorting with criminals like me? Jamie asked his sister, a definite edge to his voice. His eyes met hers straight on, matching slits of blue.
Do you ken where the money comes from, Jenny, that keeps you and your bairns and everyone here in food and the roof from falling in over your head? It's not from me printing up copies of the Psalms in Edinburgh.
And did I think it was? She flared at him. Did I ask you what you did?
No, you didn't, he flashed back. I think you'd rather not know. But you do know, don't you?
And will you blame me for what you do? It's my fault that I've children and that they must eat.
When Jenny lost her temper, she went dead white with fury. I could see him struggling to keep his own temper.
Blame you? No, of course I dinna blame you. But is it right for you to blame me, that Ian and I canna keep you all just working the land?
Jenny, too, was making an effort to subdue her rising temper.
No, she said. You do what you must, Jamie. You ken very well I didna mean you when I said criminals, but...
So you mean the men who work for me? I do the same things, Jenny. If they're criminals, what am I then?
He glared at her, eyes hot with resentment.
You're my brother, she said shortly, little pleased as I am to say so sometimes.
Damn your eyes, Jamie Fraser. You ken quite well I dinna mean to quarrel wi' whatever ye see fit to do.
If you've robbed folk on the highway or kept a whorehouse in Edinburgh, 'twould be because there was no help for it. That doesna mean I want you taking my son to be part of it.
Jamie's eyes tightened slightly at the corners at the mention of whorehouses in Edinburgh, and he darted a quick glance of accusation at Ian, who shook his head. He looked mildly stunned at his wife's ferocity.
"I've said not a word," he said briefly. "You ken how she is."
Jamie took a deep breath and turned back to Jenny, obviously determined to be reasonable.
"Aye, I see that. But you canna think I would take young Ian into danger. God, Jenny, I care for him as though he were my own son."
"Aye."
Her scepticism was pronounced.
"So that's why you encouraged him to run off from his home and kept him with you, with no word to ease our minds about where he was?"
Jamie had the grace to look abashed at this.
"Aye, well, I'm sorry for that," he muttered. "I meant to..."
He broke off with an impatient gesture.
"Well, it doesna matter what I meant. I should have sent word and I didna. But as for encouraging him to run off..." "No, I didna suppose you did," Ian interrupted. "Not directly, anyway."
The anger had faded from his long face. He looked tired now and a little sad. The bones in his face were more pronounced, leaving him hollow-cheeked in the waning afternoon light.
"It's only that the lad loves you, Jamie," he said quietly. "I see him listen when you visit and talk of what you do. I can see his face. He thinks it's all excitement and adventure, how you live, and a good long way from shovelling goat shit for his mother's garden."
He smiled briefly, despite himself. Jamie gave his brother-in-law a quick smile in return and a lifted shoulder.
"Well, but it's usual for a lad of that age to want a bit of adventure, no? You and I were the same."
"Whether he wants it or no, he shouldn't be having the sort of adventures he'll get with you,"
Jenny interrupted sharply. She shook her head, the line between her brows growing deeper as she looked disapprovingly at her brother.
"The good Lord kens as there's a charm on your life, Jamie, or you'd have been dead a dozen times."
"Aye, well, I suppose he had something in mind to preserve me for."
Jamie glanced at me with a brief smile, and his hand sought mine. Jenny darted a glance at me too,
her face unreadable, then returned to the subject at hand.
"Well, that's as may be," she said. "But I canna say as the same's true for young Ian."
Her expression softened slightly as she looked at Jamie.
"I dinna ken everything about the way you live, Jamie. But I ken you well enough to say it's likely not the way a wee laddie should live."
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie rubbed a hand over his stubbled jaw and tried again.
"Aye, well, that's what I mean about young Ian. He's carried himself like a man this last week. I dinna think it right for you to thrash him like a wee laddie, Ian."
Jenny's eyebrows rose, graceful wings of scorn.
"A man now, is he? Why, he's but a baby, Jamie. He's not but 14.
Despite his annoyance, one side of Jamie's mouth curled slightly.
"I was a man at 14, Jenny," he said softly.
She snorted, but a film of moisture shone suddenly over her eyes.
"You thought you were?"
She stood and turned away abruptly, blinking.
"I mind you then," she said,
face turned to the bookshelf. She reached out a hand as though to support herself, grasping the edge.
"You were a bonny lad, Jamie, riding off wi' Dougal to your first raid, and your dirk all bright on your thigh. I was 16, and I thought I'd never seen a sight so fair as you on your pony, so straight and tall. And I mind you coming back, too, all covered in mud and a scratch down the side of your face from falling in brambles, and Dougal boasting to Da how brawly you'd done. Driven off 6 kine by yourself, and had a dunt on the head from the flat of a broadsword, and not made a squeak about it."
Her face once more under control, she turned back from her contemplation of the books to face her brother.
"That's what a man is, aye?"
A hint of humour stole back into Jamie's face as he met her gaze.
"Aye, well, there's maybe a bit more to it than that," he said.
"Is there?"
she said, more dryly still.
"And what will that be? To be able to bed a girl? Or to kill a man?"
I had always thought Janet Fraser had something of the sight, particularly where her brother was concerned. Evidently the talent extended to her son as well. The flush over Jamie's cheekbones deepened, but his expression didn't change. She shook her head slowly, looking steadily at her brother.
"Nay, young Ian's not a man yet. But you are, Jamie, and you ken the difference very well."
Ian, who had been watching the fireworks between the two Frasers with the same fascination as I had, now coughed briefly.
"Be that as it may," he said dryly, "young Ian's been waiting for his whipping for the last quarter hour. Whether or not it's suitable to beat him, to make him wait any longer for it is a bit cruel, aye?"
"Have you really got to do it, Ian?"
Jamie made one last effort, turning to appeal to his brother-in-law.
"Well," said Ian slowly, "as I've told the lad, he's going to be thrashed, and he kens very well he's earned it. I canna just go back on my word. But as for me doing it, no, I dinna think I will."
A faint gleam of humour showed in the soft brown eyes. He reached into a drawer of the sideboard, drew out a thick leather strap, and thrust it into Jamie's hand.
"You do it."
"Me?"
Jamie was horror-struck. He made a futile attempt to shove the strap back into Ian's hand, but his brother-in-law ignored it.
"I canna thrash the lad."
"Oh, I think you can,"
Ian said calmly, folding his arms.
"You've said often enough you'd care for him as though he were your son."
He tilted his head to one side, and while his expression stayed mild, the brown eyes were implacable.
"Well, I tell you, Jamie, it's no that easy to be his da. Best ye go and find that out now, aye?"
Jamie stared at Ian for a long moment, then looked to his sister. She raised one eyebrow, staring him down.
"You deserve it as much as he does, Jamie. Get ye gone."
Jamie's lips pressed tight together and his nostrils flared white. Then he whirled on his heel and was gone without speaking. Rapid steps sounded on the boards, and a muffled slam came from the far end of the passage. Jenny cast a quick glance at Ian, a quicker one at me, and then turned to the window. Ian and I, both a good deal taller, came to stand behind her. The light outside was failing rapidly, but there was still enough to see the wilting figure of young Ian leaning dispiritedly against a wooden gate some 20 yards from the house. Looking around in trepidation at the sound of footsteps, he saw his uncle approaching and straightened up in surprise.
"Uncle Jimmy!"
His eye fell on the strap then, and he straightened a bit more.
Are you going to whip me?"
It was a still evening, and I could hear the sharp hiss of air through Jamie's teeth.
"I suppose I'll have to," he said frankly. "But first, I must apologise to you, Ian."
"To me?"
Young Ian sounded mildly dazed. Clearly he wasn't used to having his elders think they owed him an apology, especially before beating him.
"You didn't need to do that, Uncle Jimmy."
The taller figure leaned against the gate, facing the smaller one, head bent.
"Aye, I do. It was wrong of me, Ian, to let you stay in Edinburgh. And it was maybe wrong, too, to tell you stories and make you think of running away to start with. I took you to places I shouldn't have, and might have put you in danger. And I've caused more of a moil with your parents than maybe you should be in by yourself. I'm sorry for it, Ian, and I'll ask you to forgive me."
"Oh."
The smaller figure rubbed a hand through his hair, plainly at a loss for words.
"Well, aye. Of course I do, Uncle."
"Thank you, Ian."
They stood in silence for a moment. Then young Ian heaved a sigh and straightened his drooping shoulders.
"I suppose we'd best do it then."
"I expect so."
Jamie sounded at least as reluctant as his nephew, and I heard Ian next to me snort slightly, whether with indignation or amusement I couldn't tell. Resigned, young Ian turned and faced the gate without hesitation. Jamie followed more slowly. The light was nearly gone, and we could see no more than the outlines of figures at this distance, but we could hear clearly from our position at the window. Jamie was standing behind his nephew, shifting uncertainly, as though unsure what to do next.
"Mm-hmm. What does your father..."
"It's usually 10, Uncle."
Young Ian had shed his coat and tugged at his waist now, speaking over his shoulder.
12 if it's pretty bad, and 15 if it's really awful."
"Was this only bad, would you say, or pretty bad?"
There was a brief, unwilling laugh from the boy.
"If father's making you do it, Uncle Jimmy, it's really awful. But I'll settle for pretty bad. You'd better give me 12.
There was another snort from Ian at my elbow. This time it was definitely amusement.
"Honest lad," he murmured.
"All right, then."
Jamie drew in his breath and pulled his arm back, but was interrupted by young Ian.
"Wait, Uncle. I'm not quite ready." "Oh, you've got to do that."
Jamie's voice sounded a bit strangled.
"Aye. Father says only girls are whipped with their skirts down,"
young Ian explained.
"Men must take it bare-assed."
"He's damn well right about that one,"
Jamie muttered, his quarrel with Jenny obviously still rankling.
"Ready now?"
The necessary adjustments made, the larger figure stepped back and swung. There was a loud crack, and Jenny winced in sympathy with her son. Beyond a sudden intake of breath, though, the lad was silent, and stayed so through the rest of the ordeal, though I blanched a bit myself. Finally, Jamie dropped his arm and wiped his brow. He held out a hand to Ian, slumped over the fence.
"All right, lad."
Young Ian straightened up with a little difficulty this time and pulled up his breeks.
"Aye, Uncle. Thank you."
The boy's voice was a little thick, but calm and steady. He took Jamie's outstretched hand. To my surprise, though, instead of leading the boy back to the house, Jamie thrust the strap into Ian's other hand.
"Your turn,"
he announced, striding over to the gate and bending over. Young Ian was as shocked as those of us in the house.
"What?"
he said, stunned. "I said it's your turn," his uncle said in a firm voice. "I punished you. Now you've got to punish me."
"How can I do that, uncle?"
Young Ian was as scandalised as though his uncle had suggested he commit some public indecency. "Aye, you can," said Jamie, straightening up to look his nephew in the eye. "You heard what I said when I apologised to you, did you know?"
Ian nodded in a dazed fashion.
"Well then, I've done wrong just as much as you, and I've to pay for it too. I didn't like whipping you, and you're no going to like whipping me, but we're both going through with it. Understand?"
Aye, uncle," the boy stammered.
"All right, then."
Jamie tugged down his breeches, tucked up his shirt tail, and bent over once more, clutching the top rail. He waited a second, then spoke again as Ian stood paralysed, strap dangling from his nerveless hand.
"Go on."
His voice was steel, the one he used with whiskey smugglers. Not to obey was unthinkable. Ian moved timidly to do as he was ordered. Standing back, he took a half-hearted swing. There was a dull, thwacking sound.
"That one didn't account," Jamie said firmly. "Look, man, it was just as hard for me to do it to you. Make a proper job of it now."
The thin figure squared its shoulders with sudden determination, and the leather whistled through the air. It landed with a crack like lightning. There was a startled yelp from the figure on the fence, and a suppressed giggle, at least half shock, from Jenny. Jamie cleared his throat.
"Aye, that'll do. Finish it, then."
We could hear young Ian counting carefully to himself under his breath between strokes of the leather, but apart from a smothered "Christ!" at number 9, there was no further sound from his uncle. With a general sigh of relief from inside the house, Jamie rose off the fence after the last stroke and tucked his shirt into his breeks. He inclined his head formally to his nephew.
"Thank you, Ian."
Dropping the formality, he then rubbed his backside, saying in a tone of rueful admiration,
"Christ, man, you've an arm on you."
"So have you, uncle,"
said Ian, matching his uncle's wry tones. The two figures, barely visible now, stood laughing and rubbing themselves for a moment. Jamie flung an arm about his nephew's shoulders and turned him toward the house.
"If it's all the same to you, Ian, I dinna want to have to do that again, aye?"
he said confidentially.
"It's a bargain, Uncle Jamie."
A moment later, the door opened at the end of the passage, and with a look at each other, Jenny and Ian turned as one to greet the returning prodigals. Chapter 33. Buried Treasure.
"You look rather like a baboon," I observed.
"Why? And what's one of those?"
In spite of the freezing November air pouring in through the half-open window, Jamie showed no signs of discomfort as he dropped his shirt onto the small pile of clothing. He stretched luxuriously, completely naked. His joints made little popping noises as he arched his back and stretched upward, fists resting easily on the smoke-dark beams overhead.
"Oh, God, it feels good not to be on a horse."
"To say nothing of having a real bed to sleep in instead of wet heather."
I rolled over, luxuriating in the warmth of the heavy quilts and the relaxation of sore muscles into the ineffable softness of the goose-down mattress.
"Do you mean to tell me what's a baboon, then?" Jamie inquired. "Or are you just making observations for the pleasure of it?"
He turned to pick up a frayed willow twig from the washstand and began to clean his teeth. I smiled at the sight. If I'd had no other impact during my earlier sojourn in the past, I had at least been instrumental in seeing that virtually all of the Frasers and Murrays of Lallybroch retained their teeth, unlike most Highlanders. Unlike most Englishmen, for that matter.
"A baboon," I said, enjoying the sight of his muscular back flexing as he scrubbed, "is a sort of very large monkey with a red behind."
He snorted with laughter and choked on the willow twig.
"Well," he said, removing it from his mouth, "I canna fault your observations, Sassenach."
He grinned at me, showing brilliant white teeth, and tossed the twig aside.
"'It's been 30 years since anyone took a tours to me,' he added, "'passing his hands tenderly over the still glowing surfaces of his rear. "'I'd forgot how much it stings.'
"'And here young Ian was speculating that your ass was tough as saddle leather,' I said, amused. "'Was it worth it, do you think?'
"'Oh, aye,' he said, matter-of-factly, sliding into bed beside me.
"'His body was hard and cold as marble, and I squeaked, "'but didn't protest as he gathered me firmly against his chest.
"'Christ, you're warm,' he murmured. "'Come closer, hm?'
"'His legs insinuated themselves between mine,' and he cupped my bottom, drawing me in. He gave a sigh of pure content, and I relaxed against him, feeling our temperatures start to equalise through the thin cotton of the nightdress Jenny had lent me. The peat fire in the hearth had been lit, but hadn't been able to do much yet toward dispelling the chill. Body heat was much more effective.
"'Oh, aye, that was worth it,' he said. "'I could have beaten young Ian half senseless.' His father has once or twice. And it would have done nothing but make him more determined to run off once he got the chance. But he'll walk through hot coals before he risks having to do something like that again.
He spoke with certainty, and I thought he was undoubtedly right. Young Ian, looking bemused, had received absolution from his parents in the form of a kiss from his mother and a swift hug from his father, and then retired to his bed with a handful of cakes. There, no doubt, to ponder the curious consequences of disobedience. Jamie, too, had been absolved with kisses, and I suspected that this was more important to him than the effects of his performance on young Ian.
"'At least Jenny and Ian aren't angry with you any longer,' I said.
"'No. It's no really that they were angry so much, I think. It's only that they didn't ken what to do with a lad,' he explained. They've raised two sons already, and young Jamie and Michael are fine lads both. But both of them are more like Ian, soft-spoke and easy in their manner. Young Ian's quiet enough, but he's a great deal more like his mother and me.
Fraser's a stubborn, eh? I said, smiling.
This bit of clan doctrine was one of the first things I had learned when I met Jamie. And nothing in my subsequent experience had suggested that it might be an error. He chuckled, soft and deep in his chest.
Aye, that's so. Young Ian may look like a Murray, but he's a Fraser born all right. And it's no use to shout at a stubborn man, or beat him either. It only makes him more set on having his way.
I'll bear that in mind, I said dryly. One hand was stroking my thigh, gradually inching the cotton nightdress upward. Jamie's internal furnace had resumed its operations, and his bare legs were warm and hard against mine. One knee nudged gently, seeking an entrance between my thighs. I cupped his buttocks and squeezed gently.
Dorcas told me that a number of gentlemen pay very well for the privilege of being smacked at the brothel. She says they find it arousing.
Jamie snorted briefly, tensing his buttocks, then relaxing as I stroked them lightly.
Do they, then? I suppose it's true if Dorcas says so. But I canna see it myself. There are a great many more pleasant ways to get a cock stand, if you ask me.
On the other hand, he added fairly, perhaps it makes a difference if it's a bonny wee lassie in her shift on the other end of the strap,
and not your father. Or your nephew, come to that.
Perhaps it does. Shall I try sometime?
The hollow of his throat lay just by my face, sunburned and delicate, showing the faint white triangle of a scar just above the wide arch of his collarbone. I set my lips on the pulse beat there, and he shivered, though neither of us was cold any longer.
No, he said, a little breathless.
His hand fumbled at the neck of my shift, pulling loose the ribbons. He rolled onto his back then, lifting me suddenly above him as though I weighed nothing at all. A flick of his finger brought the loosened chemise down over my shoulders, and my nipples rose at once as the cold air struck them. His eyes were more slanted than usual as he smiled up at me, half-lidded as a drowsing cat, and the warmth of his palms encircled both breasts.
I said I could think of more pleasant ways, aye.
The candle had guttered and gone out. The fire on the hearth burned low, and a pale November starlight shone through the misted window. Dim as it was, my eyes were so adapted to the dark that I could pick out all the details of the room, the thick white porcelain jug and basin, its blue band black in the starlight, the small embroidered sampler on the wall, and the rumpled heap of Jamie's clothes on the stool by the bed. Jamie was clearly visible, too, covers thrown back, chest gleaming faintly from exertion. I admired the long slope of his belly, where small whorls of dark auburn hair spiraled up across the pale, fresh skin. I couldn't keep my fingers from touching him, tracing the lines of the powerfully sprung ribs that shaped his torso. "It's so good," I said dreamily. "So good to have a man's body to touch." "Do you like it still, then?" He sounded half shy, half pleased as I fondled him. His own arm came around my shoulder, stroking my hair. "Mm-hmm." It wasn't a thing I had consciously missed, but having it now reminded me of the joy of it, that drowsy intimacy in which a man's body is as accessible to you as your own, the strange shapes and textures of it like a sudden extension of your own limbs. I ran my hand down the flat slope of his belly, over the smooth jut of hip bone and the swell of muscled thigh. The remnants of firelight caught the red-gold fuzz on arms and legs, and glowed in the auburn thicket nested between his thighs.
"God, you are a wonderfully hairy creature," I said, "even there."
I slid my hand down the smooth crease of his thigh, and he spread his legs obligingly, letting me touch the thick, springy curls in the crease of his buttocks.
"I will. No one's hunted me yet for my pelt," he said comfortably.
His hand cupped my own rear firmly, and a large thumb passed gently over the rounded surface. He propped one arm behind his head and looked lazily down the length of my body.
"You're even less worth the skinning than I am, Sassenach."
"I should hope so." I moved slightly to accommodate his touch as he extended his explorations, enjoying the warmth of his hand on my naked back.
"Ever seen a smooth branch that's been in still water a long time?" he asked.
A finger passed lightly up my spine, raising a ripple of goose flesh in its wake.
"There are tiny wee bubbles on it, hundreds and thousands and millions of them, so it looks as though it's furred all about wee a silver frost."
His fingers brushed my ribs, my arms, my back, and the tiny down hairs rose everywhere in the wake of his touch, tingling.
"That's what you look like, my Sassenach," he said,
almost whispering,
"all smooth and naked, dipped in silver."
Then we lay quiet for a time, listening to the drip of rain outside. A cold autumn air drifted through the room, mingling with the fire's smoky warmth. He rolled onto his side, facing away from me, and drew the quilts up to cover us. I curled up behind him, knees fitting neatly behind his own. The firelight shone dully from behind me now, gleaming over the smooth round of his shoulder and dimly illuminating his back. I could see the faint lines of the scars that webbed his shoulders, thin streaks of silver on his flesh. At one time I had known those scars so intimately I could have traced them with my fingers blindfolded. Now there was a thin half-moon curve I didn't know, a diagonal slash that hadn't been there before, the remnants of a violent past I hadn't shared. I touched the half-moon, tracing its length.
"No one's hunted you for your pelt," I said softly. "But they've hunted you, haven't they?"
His shoulder moved slightly, not quite a shrug.
"Now and then," he said.
"Now?" I asked. He breathed slowly for a moment or two before answering.
"Aye," he said. "I think so."
My fingers moved down to the diagonal slash. It had been a deep cut, old and well healed as the damage was. The line was sharp and clear beneath my fingertips. Do you know who?
No.
He was quiet for a moment, then his hand closed over my own where it lay across his stomach.
But I maybe ken why.
The house was very quiet. With most of the children and grandchildren gone, there were only the far-off servants in their quarters behind the kitchen. Ian and Jenny in their room at the far end of the hall, and young Ian somewhere upstairs, all asleep. We could have been alone at the end of the world. Both Edinburgh and the Smuggler's Cove seemed very far away.
Do you recall after the fall of Stirling, not so long before Culloden, when all of a sudden there was gossip from everywhere about gold being sent from France?
From Louis? Yes, but he never sent it. Jamie's words summoned up those brief, frantic days of Charles Stuart's reckless rise and precipitous fall, when rumour had been the common currency of conversation. There was always gossip about gold from France, ships from Spain, weapons from Holland, but nothing came of most of it.
Oh, something came, though not from Louis, but no one kent it then.
He told me then of his meeting with the dying Duncan Kerr, and the wanderer's whispered words heard in the inn's attic under the watchful eye of an English officer.
He was fevered, Duncan, but not crazed wi' it. He kent he was dying, and he kent me too. It was his only chance to tell someone he thought he could trust, so he told me.
White witches and seals? I repeated. I must say it sounds like gibberish, but you understood it.
Well, not all of it,
Jamie admitted. He rolled over to face me, frowning slightly.
I've no notion who the White Witch might be. At the first, I thought he meant you, Sassenach, and my heart nearly stopped when he said it.
He smiled ruefully, and his hand tightened on mine, clasped between us.
I thought all at once that perhaps something had gone wrong. Maybe you'd not been able to get back to Frank and the place you came from. Maybe you'd somehow ended in France. Maybe you were there right then. All kinds of fancies went through my head.
I wish it had been true, I whispered. He gave me a lopsided smile, but shook his head.
And me in prison? And Brianna would be what, just 10 or so? No, dinna waste your time in regretting, Sassenach. You're here now, and you'll never leave me again.
He kissed me gently on the forehead, then resumed his tale.
I didn't have any idea where the gold had come from, but I kent his telling me where it was and why it was there. It was Prince Chalice, sent for him, and the bit about the silkies.
He raised his head a little and nodded toward the window where the rose briar cast its shadows on the glass.
Folk said when my mother ran away from Leoch that she'd gone to live with the silkies. Only because the maid that saw my father when he took her said as he looked like a great silky who'd shed his skin and come to walk on the land like a man. And he did.
Jamie smiled and passed a hand through his own thick hair, remembering.
He had hair thick as mine, but a black like jet. It would shine in some lights as though it was wet, and he moved quick and sleekit, like a seal through the water.
He shrugged suddenly, shaking off the recollection of his father.
Well, so, when Duncan Kerr said the name Ellen, I kent it was my mother he meant, as a sign that he knew my name and my family, kent who I was, that he wasn't a raving, no matter how it sounded. And knowing that,
he shrugged again.
The Englishman had told me where they found Duncan near the coast. There are hundreds of bitty isles and rocks all down that coast, but only one place where the silkies live. At the ends of the Mackenzie Lands, off Coigach.
So you went there?
Aye, I did.
He sighed deeply, his free hand drifting to the hollow of my waist.
I wouldn't have done it, left the prison, I mean, had I not still thought it maybe had something to do with you, Sassenach.
This ends Disc 17. Voyager, Disc 18.
Escape had been an enterprise of no great difficulty. Prisoners were often taken outside in small gangs to cut the peats that burned on the prison's hearths, or to cut and haul stone for the ongoing work of repairing the walls. For a man to whom the heather was home, disappearing had been easy. He had risen from his work and turned aside by a hummock of grass, unfastening his breeches as though to relieve himself. The guard had looked politely away, and, looking back a moment later, beheld nothing but an empty moor, holding no trace of Jamie Fraser.
"See, it was little trouble to slip off, but men seldom did," he explained. "None of us were from near Ardsmuir, and had we been, there was little left for most of the men to gang to."
The Duke of Cumberland's men had done their work well. As one contemporary had put it, evaluating the Duke's achievement later, "He created a desert and called it peace." This modern approach to diplomacy had left some parts of the Highlands all but deserted, the men killed, imprisoned, or transported, crops and houses burned, the women and children turned out to starve, or seek refuge elsewhere as best they might. No, a prisoner escaping from Ardsmuir would have been truly alone, without kin or clan to turn to for succour. Jamie had known there would be little time before the English commander realised where he must be heading and organised a party of pursuit. On the other hand, there were no real roads in this remote part of the kingdom, and a man who knew the country was at a greater advantage on foot than were the pursuing outlanders on horseback. He had made his escape in mid-afternoon. Taking his bearings by the stars, he had walked through the night, arriving at the coast near dawn the next day.
"See, I kent the Silkies' place. It's well known amongst the Mackenzies, and had been there once before, wi Dougal."
The tide had been high, and the seals mostly out in the water, hunting crabs and fish among the fronds of floating kelp. But the dark streaks of their droppings and the indolent forms of a few idlers marked the seals' three islands, ranged in a line just inside the lip of a small bay, guarded by a cliff-like headland. By Jamie's interpretation of Duncan's instructions, the treasure lay on the third island, the farthest away from the shore. It was nearly a mile out, a long swim, even for a strong man, and his own strength was sapped from the hard prison labour and the long walk without food. He had stood on the cliff top, wondering whether this was a wild goose chase, and whether the treasure, if there was one, was worth the risk of his life.
"The rock was all split and broken there. When I came too close to the edge, chunks would fall away from my feet and plummet down the cliff. I didn't see how I'd ever reach the water, let alone the seal's isle. But then I was minded what Duncan had said about Ellen's tower," Jamie said.
His eyes were open, fixed not on me, but on that distant shore where the crash of falling rock was lost in the smashing of the waves. The tower was there, a small spike of granite that stuck up no more than 5 feet from the tip of the headland. But below that spike, hidden by the rocks, was a narrow crack, a small chimney that ran from top to bottom of the 80-foot cliff, providing a possible passage, if not an easy one, for a determined man. From the base of Ellen's tower to the third island was still over a quarter of a mile of heaving green water. Undressing, he had crossed himself, and commending his soul to the keeping of his mother, he had dived naked into the waves. He made his way slowly out from the cliff, floundering and choking as the waves broke over his head. No place in Scotland is that far from the sea, but Jamie had been raised inland, his experience of swimming limited to the placid depths of lochs and the pools of trout streams. Blinded by salt and deafened by the roaring surf, he had fought the waves for what seemed hours, then thrust his head and shoulders free, gasping for breath, only to see the headland looming, not behind, as he had thought, but to his right.
"The tide was going out and I was going with it," he said wryly. "I thought, well, that's it then, I'm gone, for I knew I could never make my way back. I hadn't eaten anything in 2 days and hadn't much strength left."
He ceased swimming then, and simply spread himself on his back, giving himself to the embrace of the sea. Light-headed from hunger and effort, he had closed his eyes against the light, and searched his mind for the words of the old Celtic prayer against drowning. He paused for a moment then, and was quiet for so long that I wondered whether something was wrong. But at last he drew breath and said shyly,
"I expect you'll think I'm daft, Sassenach. I haven't told anyone about it, not even Jenny. But I heard my mother call me then, right in the middle of praying."
He shrugged, uncomfortable.
"It was maybe only that I'd been thinking of her when I left the shore," he said. "And yet..."
He fell silent until I touched his face. "What did she say?" I asked quietly.
"She said, 'Come here to me, Jamie. Come to me, laddie.'"
He drew a deep breath and let it out slowly. "I could hear her, plain as day, but I couldn't see anything. There was no one there, not even a silky. I thought she was calling me from heaven, and I was so tired I really would not have minded dying then. But I rolled myself over and struck out toward where I'd heard her voice. I thought I would swim 10 strokes and then stop again to rest, or to sink. But on the 8th stroke, the current had taken him. 'It was just as though someone had picked me up,' he said, sounding still surprised at the memory of it. 'I could feel it under me and all around. The water was a bit warmer than it had been, and it carried me with it. I didn't have to do anything but paddle a bit to keep my head above water.' A strong, curling current, eddying between headland and islands, it had taken him to the edge of the 3rd islet, where no more than a few strokes brought him within reach of its rocks. It was a small lump of granite, fissured and creviced like all the ancient rocks of Scotland, and slimed with seaweed and seal droppings to boot, but he crawled on shore with all the thankfulness of a shipwrecked sailor for a land of palm trees and white sand beaches. He fell down upon his face on the rocky shelf and lay there, grateful for breath, half dozing with exhaustion.
"Then I felt something looming over me, and there was a terrible stink of dead fish," he said. "I got up onto my knees at once, and there he was, a great bull seal, all sleek and wet, and his black eyes staring at me, no more than a yard away."
Neither fisher nor seaman himself, Jamie had heard enough stories to know that bull seals were dangerous, particularly when threatened by intrusions upon their territory. Looking at that open mouth with its fine display of sharp, peg-like teeth and the burly rolls of hard fat that girdled the enormous body, he wasn't disposed to doubt it.
"He weighed more than 20 stone, Sassenach," he said. "If it wasn't inclined to rip the flesh off my bones, still he could have knocked me into the sea with one swipe, or dragged me under to drown."
"Obviously he didn't, though," I said dryly. "What happened?" He laughed.
"I think I was too mazed from tiredness to do anything sensible," he said. "I just looked at him for a moment, and then I said, 'That's all right, it's only me.'"
"And what did the seal do?" Jamie shrugged slightly.
"He looked me over for a bit longer. Silkies dinna blink much, did you know that? It's very unnerving to have one look at you for long. Then he gave a sort of a grunt and slid off the rock into the water."
Left in sole possession of the tiny islet, Jamie had sat blankly for a time, recovering his strength, and then at last began a methodical search of the crevices. Small as the area was, it took little time to find a deep split in the rock that led down to a wide hollow space, a foot below the rocky surface. Floored with dry sand and located in the centre of the island, the hollow would be safe from flooding in all but the worst storms.
"Well, don't keep me in suspense," I said, poking him in the stomach. "Was the French gold there?"
"Well, it was and it wasn't, Sassenach," he answered, neatly sucking in his stomach. "I'd been expecting gold bullion. That's what the rumour said that Louis would send. And 30,000 pounds worth of gold bullion would make a good-sized hoard. But all there was in the hollow was a box, less than a foot long, and a small leather pouch. The box did have gold in it, though, and silver, too."
"Gold and silver, indeed.
The wooden box had contained 205 coins, gold ones and silver ones, some as sharply cut as though new minted, some with their markings worn nearly to blankness.
Ancient coins, Sasana.
Ancient? What? You mean very old?
Greek, Sasanach, and Roman. Very old indeed.
We lay staring at each other in the dim light for a moment, not speaking.
That's incredible, I said at last.
It's treasure, all right, but not... Not what Louis would send to help feed an army.
No,
he finished for me.
No, whoever put this treasure there, it wasn't a Louis or any of his ministers.
What about the bag? I said, suddenly remembering. What was in the pouch you found?
Stones, Sasanach. Gemstones. Diamonds and pearls and emeralds and sapphires. Not many, but nicely cut and big enough.
He smiled a little grimly.
Aye, big enough.
He had sat on the rock under the dim grey sky, turning the coins and the jewels over and over between his fingers, stunned into bewilderment. At last, roused by a sensation of being watched, he had looked up to find himself surrounded by a circle of curious seals. The tide was out. The females had come back from their fishing, and 20 pairs of round black eyes surveyed him cautiously. The huge black male, emboldened by the presence of his harem, had come back too. He barked loudly, darting his head threateningly from side to side, and advanced on Jamie, sliding his 300-pound bulk a few feet closer with each booming exclamation, propelling himself with his flippers across the slick rock.
"I thought I'd best leave then," he said. "I'd found what I came to find, after all. So I put the box and the pouch back where I'd found them. I couldn't carry them ashore, after all. And if I did, what then? So I put them back and crawled down into the water, half frozen with cold."
A few strokes from the island had taken him again into the current heading landward. It was a circular current, like most eddies, and the gyre had carried him to the foot of the headland within half an hour, where he crawled ashore, dressed, and fell asleep in a nest of marrow grass. He paused then, and I could see that while his eyes were open and fixed on me, it wasn't me they saw.
"I woke at dawn," he said softly. "I have seen a great many dawns, Sasanach, but never one like that one."
I could feel the earth turn beneath me, and my own breath coming with the breathing of the wind. It was as though I had no skin nor bone, but only the light of the rising sun inside me. His eyes softened as he left the moor and came back to me.
"So, then the sun came up higher," he said, matter-of-factly. "And when it warmed me enough to stand, I got up and went inland toward the road to meet the English."
"But why did you go back?" I demanded. "You were free. You had money and..."
"And where would I spend such money as that, Sasanach?" he asked. "Walk into a cotter's hearth and offer him a gold denarius or a wee emerald?"
He smiled at my indignation and shook his head.
"Nay," he said gently, "I had to go back. Aye, I could have lived on the moor for a time, half starved and naked, but I might have managed. But they were hunting me, Sasanach, and hunting hard, for thinking that I might know where the gold was hid. No cot near Ardsmuir would be safe from the English so long as I was free, and might be thought to seek refuge there." "I've seen the English hunting, ye ken," he added, a harder note creeping into his voice. "You'll have seen the panel in the entry hall."
I had. One panel of the glowing oak that lined the hall below had been smashed in, perhaps by a heavy boot, and the criss-cross scars of sabre-slashes marred the panelling from door to stairs.
"We keep it so to remember," he said, "to show to the Wains, and tell them when they ask, this is what the English are."
The suppressed hate in his voice struck me low in the pit of the stomach. Knowing what I knew of what the English army had done in the Highlands, there was bloody little I could say in argument. I said nothing, and he continued after a moment.
"I wouldn't expose the folk near Ardsmuir to that kind of attention, Sasanach."
At the word Sassenach, his hand squeezed mine, and a small smile curved the corner of his mouth. Sassenach I might be to him, but not English.
"For that matter," he went on, "were I not taken, the hunt would likely come here again.